Welcome to The Technology Pill, a podcast that looks at how technology is reshaping our lives every day and exploring the different ways that governments and companies use tech to increase their power. My name is Gus Hossain, and I'm the Executive Director of Privacy International.
And I'm Caitlin, and I'm PI Senior Campaigns Officer. Hi.
And so, Caitlin, you have us for the second time talking about encryption.
Yes.
Because the first time wasn't enough.
No.
We are here talking about encryption, not just from a technological perspective, but from a legal one.
Yes. So the theory goes, who knows if it's accurate, but the theory goes, you now understand what encryption is. So you kind of have a vague understanding of some of the maths involved. You kind of know vaguely how it works. But the problem is, whether it works or not, if governments decide to step in and screw it all up, then the maths is less relevant. And so this podcast is about the ways in which governments around the world, and largely the Russian government, have tried to screw it up, and the ways in which we are trying to protect encryption.
And that's great that we have our colleague Yanis, who's going to join us to take us through this really interesting case arising from Russia that will, we hope, protect encryption's use for everybody across Europe and set a global standard.
Nice.
Math.
So if we start with Yanis, why don't you introduce yourself? Because I think only you can give yourself the appropriate amount of hype.
Hi, everyone. My name is Yanis, and I'm a senior lawyer at Privacy International.
So do you want to tell us why you're here? You've done some lawyering.
Actually, senior lawyering?
Oh, not just any kind of lawyering. Senior lawyering.
Not just basic lawyering. It was like next level. It was meta lawyering, though it didn't have to do with meta. I mean, indirectly, it might have had to do with meta. I don't know. Like, that more had to do with Telegram, so tele-lawyering.
I mean, technically, wasn't it deputy general counsel lawyering?
Stop promoting Yanis, okay?
Okay, anyway, so tele-lawyering. Tell us what tele-lawyering you've been up to.
Tele-lawyering I've been up to was this new case that the court handed down judgment in a couple of weeks ago. And it's a case that started a few years back. It's a case before the European Court of Human Rights. It's a case that has to do with Russia. Basically, this case, I think, is part of several cases that were brought against Russia and concern the very touchy slash sensitive, nonetheless important issue of encryption and encrypted communications. So basically, why I said tele-lawyering is because the case predominantly has to do with Telegram. That's the main sort of applicant, the main party that brought the case before the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg against Russia. The case deals with a series of measures that the Russian security services devised to force, among other things, telecommunications providers such as Telegram, for example, or other companies that provide online communication services to store communications data, basically the communications or the messages between users, for a certain or very long amount of time. And more importantly, what's sort of spicier in this case, to provide decryption keys to decrypt these messages in case they are encrypted. So to provide decryption keys to Russian authorities, Telegram, for example, would have to, in case someone was using a sort of encrypted service of Telegram or an encrypted chat with someone, they would have to provide the keys to decrypt this encrypted chat, this encrypted communication, to the Russian authorities so that they could have access to it, investigate it, and so on and so forth. And as many other people, Telegram did not like this idea, which was arguably quite absurd, and challenged it. So this resulted in a series of cases after domestic proceedings were concluded in Russia, or not so concluded, or in any case, all the parties there had sort of used all the possible avenues they had at their disposal.
And sorry, just to be clear, this was based on a law in Russia passed around what time? Like 20?
Oh, that's a great question. We intervened in the case in 2021. So this basically has to do with a Russian law that imposed an obligation to indiscriminately retain the content and the communications data for certain periods. And then in 2017, the Russian Federal Security Service, FSB, issued a disclosure order, a specific disclosure order in 2017 that was aimed at Telegram. And it required Telegram to disclose technical information to facilitate the decoding of communications.
Of all communications at any moment in time. It wasn't just in one specific case, right?
No. It was very indiscriminate. So yeah. We first have the Russian law that kind of imposes an obligation on telecommunications providers to retain and hold this data indiscriminately. So I assume what came in 2017 is basically that if this was taking place, the Russian authorities might have come across actually encrypted messages. They didn't know how to decrypt them or what to do with them. So in 2017 came the order to Telegram to, hi, please provide the decryption keys because we can't read some of the things we got from you. And this decryption order was met with a lot of criticism. And as I said, their legal actions were brought. Serious lawyering was done.
And just to describe to non-lawyers, what serious lawyering has to be done first, the case has to be taken in Russia to begin with. And it has to be taken by serious lawyers in Russia, essentially what they call exhausting the Russian legal system, which is going through all the courts in Russia to the point where they have to appeal to some foreign body, which is, in this case, the European Court of Human Rights.
Exactly. And that's basically because there is a very old precedent and the whole concept upon which the European Court of Human Rights is based on, which is that its function, its role, it's a subsidiary to national institutions, and you can't just go to the European Court of Human Rights whenever you don't agree with a measure or without first trying to challenge the measure domestically in your own country, hoping that, you know, the European Court is going to give a solution to your issue right away. So yes, first you need to basically exhaust all possible legal avenues. And once you have done that and you're still not satisfied with the outcome, you can take your case to the European Court of Human Rights considering it concerns, if you think it concerns one of the rights that are safeguarded or enshrined.
And so that's where we got involved with our intervention, because I guess in 2021, the case arrived at the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights said, yes, we'll at some point deal with this case. And PI jumped in 2021 with an intervention. What's an intervention?
So before getting there, one can imagine this case does deal with lots of human rights issues, and I think most importantly, privacy and freedom of expression. So, as I said earlier, there were several cases. So Telegram brought its own case against Russia, but what's interesting, there is also several cases that were brought by individual users. And the case in which a judgment was handed down a couple of weeks ago, the case of Podchasov versus Russia, was the case of a single user that was brought against the Russian authorities.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So you have Telegram. So you have the company that's bringing like the big case and so on. Telegram versus Russia, also before the European Court of Human Rights. And accompanying that, you have several cases. I think it's at least 20, 30, maybe more, that are from individual users. Though these cases have now been joined, but they're still pending. And what happened? These cases reached Strasbourg. Strasbourg sort of initially examined these complaints, these applications, and later on communicated the case to the Russian government, asking for their input. And that's where we jump in. Once a case is communicated, that's where the sort of window of opportunity to intervene opens up for a specific time period. That's where we identified the issue and we intervened. And it's worth saying that we did not just intervene in this case, we've also intervened in the sort of main Telegram case, the Telegram versus Russia, together with several other civil society organizations. And we have discussed quite some novel privacy and freedom of expression issues, because the sort of main privacy one also touched on freedom of expression. So we thought it was a very good opportunity to also discuss the impact that the Russian measures could have on that right. That's where we intervened and we submitted the intervention in 2021, not so long ago. Usually one would expect the European Court of Human Rights sort of like sounds like a fancy court. How many cases can it have? Well, it has thousands of cases and proceedings can take lots of years.
And does it matter at all that this case started at a time when Russia was still part of the Council of Europe and therefore was still party to the European Convention of Human Rights on Human Rights? And now, if I understand correctly, because I know that Russia has been thrown out of the Council of Europe, does that mean it's really not quite subject to the European Court of Human Rights anymore?
That's correct. And that's indeed a great question, Gus. When the case started, when all this happened, there was no war in Ukraine. There was no Russian atrocities. What happened after that was that Russia left the Council of Europe and therefore was no longer subject to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights, let's say. So once this happened, no new cases can be brought. And the issue remained about the cases that were previously brought and not adjudicated yet. And I think what's happening is that if the cases concern a conduct that occurred until the date, the actual date that Russia left the Council of Europe, it is considered to still be bound by the jurisdiction of the court, because by the time it left the Council of Europe, actually, Russia was still a member and like the convention, the European Convention of Human Rights would still apply on its territory. Any new case brought now, for example, would be declared inadmissible because the court would have no longer jurisdiction. Russia is not bound by the convention. So yes, the contact that was complained about in this case and in all the Telegram related case took place quite before that in time, and the court was able to examine it. We see lots of cases against Russia being handed down during this time, especially concerning conditions surrounding detention of political dissidents and so on. But interestingly, in most of these cases, Russia has not appeared to sort of defend itself or provide any input, so the case is kind of examined only through the perspective of the applicant. However, in our very specific case, we do an intervention. We get a deadline by the court to submit our intervention. We sit down, we make sure everything fits within 10 pages because there is a very specific limit. And
because lawyers are wordy.
Yes. And also you can't use tiny font because that's like cheating. You can use like, I don't know, we use Gilroy at PI. So I guess maximum you can go is 9, not below 9 still. Anyway, it was difficult because we also were very inspired. We did some drawing because we figured out that this is a really important issue. It might be a good idea to explain to the court how encryption works. Technically, just in case, they don't know, just in case. And we dived into the technical details a bit too, besides the legal stuff, and then explained why it matters from a legal perspective or what the dangers are. Anyway, so we submitted our intervention. Usually or normally, this is where it would end. You send off your intervention and then the court takes forever, usually. There might be a written procedure, there might be a hearing, there might be more back and forth in communications between the two main parties, the applicant and the state, the government. But your role as an intervener kind of stops there. You provide your input to the court because your aim is to assist the court and, you know, provide, bring in some insights or bring in a comparative perspective or whatever it is that can help the court decide the case better. Then you hear about the potential judgment coming out at some point in the future. What's interesting in this case is a few weeks after I got a letter from the court and the court said, we have a communication for you from the Russian government. The Russian government has also responded to your intervention.
The Russian government knows who you are.
That's fine. I'm not planning to visit Russia anytime soon. Yeah, so basically they had responded and they seem to be quite upset with the content of our intervention or the issues, not the issues because we're not really discussing the facts of the case. That's not our job as an intervener. I don't think they were really disagreeing with the technical nature of encryption because also, you know, it's like a technical aspect, basic maths. It's not really so much to question, not as much as an opinion. I think they were disagreeing with the sort of legal applicability of certain concepts and principles. I don't entirely remember. It was not in Russian. It was everything else. It was like in Russian. And I was like, what is this? Like, the actual text was in English. Maybe we should publish it on our case page now that we need
Absolutely.
To update it. Yeah, stay tuned. Like, it's going to drop soon. So Russian government sent their comments. We read them. We're like, okay. Usually when you get angry response, it means you're doing something really well. So we thought maybe we're onto something here, or maybe it can be helpful for the court. Fingers crossed. We did not respond to the comments. I don't think there was an opportunity to actually respond to the Russian government comments. Because as I said, like, the main parties concerned are the applicant and the government. It's not really for the intervener, the third party, us to like occupy the proceedings. So this happened and then it all stopped as usual. Like, you know, we went on with our lives. We did senior lawyering in other things. And we recently...
The pandemic came to an end.
The pandemic came to an end.
A war broke out.
A new war broke out. Now, like end of January, beginning February, don't remember exactly when, we get word that there is a case that's going to be handed down on February 14th. And I was like, great, because I'm single, so I didn't really have any plans on that day.
I seem to recall you saying FML on one of the chats at FBI, saying, oh, come on. Does this have to happen now?
Yeah. Lots of things that were happening at PI level internally, like admin things, planning, other ongoing senior lawyering, project-related things and developments. And on top of that, we randomly find out that the judgment in that case is going to be handed down. I'm sorry, we got this all wrong, guys. It was the 13th of February, Tuesday the 13th. So Tuesday the 13th, we logged in the morning. We prepare for all possible scenarios. Usually I prepare for the worst possible scenario. But in this case, and I think I speak on behalf of everyone in the team, that it exceeded pretty much everyone's expectations. The outcome was overwhelmingly positive. We did not only got a really nice judgment that basically found a violation on the part of the Russian government and found that the applicant's right to privacy, for example, was unlawfully interfered with. On top of that, the court made some very interesting remarks about encryption, the importance or necessity of encryption as a tool for today's online communications, which is great. I think it's the first time we see that. On top of that, the court also made some really interesting remarks around the security or architecture of the internet for, I don't know, government measures, for example, that seek to exploit encryption by relying on backdoor or vulnerabilities, and what this could mean for the security of each and every user using that service if a vulnerability is left exposed or exploited by third parties. This builds a lot on our intervention, so we're very glad to see that because it's a very similar point that we also made when we put our intervention forward, when we submitted it to the court. And we were very glad to see it. Between me and you, and of course our audience of thousands of listeners, I was not expecting the court to go that far. I don't know if it's the current environment with Russia's departure from the Council of Europe or the absurdity of that specific order that was being challenged in this case, or a strong familiarity of judges, as they should, I believe, of modern communication tools like encryption and so on, that made the court go this far. But yeah, I was not expecting them to go this far. They were very, like, for senior lawyering, this could be considered a woke judgment. So...
Well, you just hope there's nobody from the European Court of Human Rights listening.
So yeah, I think it went quite well. I think it's a very good judgment. And what's more important is that it does not stop at Russia.
Yes, that was what I wanted to get to, because Russia is now out of the Council of Europe. The European Court of Human Rights doesn't really have jurisdiction over Russia, or Russia's no longer having to follow any of the judgments. But we're somewhat grateful for Russia for having, as a final gift to the European Court of Human Rights and to the Convention on Human Rights, of having had such a bad law and such a bad practice, that there are people in Russia who are willing to stand up against the government and take this case through its very patient process all the way to the court so that we could actually raise some issues. Fine, we did that. Russia's gone. But this still matters to everybody else whose country is in the Council of Europe, right?
That's correct. And maybe not only. I mean, we have the European Court of Human Rights. It's a big thing. And it's kind of like has this binding precedent, especially when it comes to the other countries that are members of the Council of Europe.
And just a note, there's 50 plus countries in the Council of Europe. This is not the European Union. This is a massive body of practically every country in like geographic Europe, except now for Russia,
but still the UK is in the Council of Europe, a Council of Europe member state, and let's hope it stays that way. And all EU member states are members of the Council of Europe. So it's all the EU and not only. And the reason it does not just stop at Russia is because the court has its body of case law, which is basically a precedent that binds it when it comes to interpreting certain rights or discussing certain measures. And now the judgment in Podchaso versus Russia, the one we're discussing, is now part of the court's precedent. It's now part of the court's jurisprudence that can be used in a similar case if it were to be brought against a different member state of the Council of Europe, or that the court would have to rely on if it were to examine a similar or identical case taking place in a different jurisdiction.
So what you're saying is if there was a similar law or power in France or Germany or the United Kingdom, organizations could take a similar case about that French, German, or UK law all the way to the European Court of Human Rights.
Exactly.
But ideally, it goes beyond that, doesn't it? Which is ideally every intelligence agency across Europe will have woken up saying, God damn it, I get this from the European Court of Human Rights, which says, oh, we can't do this anymore, or we can't try to pass a law like this anymore. It's not quite that preventative, but it's close, isn't it?
Relatively close. I mean, as a precedent, it basically builds on previous precedent that was handed down by the court. It's not that it woke up one day out of the blue and decided, I'm going to go this far. Obviously, it takes like a lot of cases and an evolution in the court's case law.
And senior lawyering by you.
And senior lawyering. But what it basically says is some form of general guidance to governments or policymakers. Like, you cannot indiscriminately affect a measure by looking to take advantage of backdoors and then affect the security of every user just because you might want to preemptively target one in the future. I mean, this sounds very basic, and it is. I don't know why we would expect the court to say it, you know, like it's self-explanatory, but
okay. But in this day and age, with the policymakers we're stuck with.
Yeah, and I think like the judgment is going to come in handy in the future. If we consider the very random example, very hypothetical example, let's say the EU adopts a regulation that wants to circumvent encryption by forcing communications providers to police the web for, I don't know, child sexual abuse material, and they want to spy on communications of everyone, even the encrypted ones. And many people are not happy, and the users who are being affected because their communication services that they consider secure to communicate with friends, family, loved ones, whatever it may be without interference, are now being scanned. And the basis of this scanning is the exploitation of faults in the software that providers are meant to exploit so that they can basically access these communications. Let's say this scenario took place and the case was brought against a state that, you know, for jurisdictional purposes, let's say the user resides in Germany and it brings like a case against Germany on that premise, the court would have to refer to this case, the Podchaso versus Russia one, would build on that one. If it were to differ from that one, it would have to justify so, being that the facts are extremely different or it has nothing to do with that case.
Yeah.
Though, as we can see, like there is a very similar premise, so this would not be the case. But the court would have to bring in this one. And us interfering with senior lawyering, our intervention would build on that very case, saying that you ruled this in this case. This case is very similar and it poses an equally like grave danger. You need to also rule that it violates the convention, and the German government cannot do that.
Well, they would also send you a letter about how unhappy they are with you.
I don't think the Germans would do that. They're very polite, and no, I don't think the Germans would send me a letter. No.
You could start a collection.
We've been joking along the way about, you know, it takes our lawyering in order for this to happen. I'm sorry, our senior lawyering for this to happen. But I see a lot of organizations throwing interventions at courts. And then when the court rules, everybody stands up and says, hey, we won that case. And I actually find interventions to be a very weak form of advocacy. We certainly know the Russians listened to you and they didn't like what you had to say. But what makes you think that the European court actually heeded what you had to say in this case?
Well, first of all, it should be mentioned that it was not just us that intervened in this case. It was also another organization. So it was a total of two interveners. And I think the other organizations was on the same page as we were. So
who were the other organization?
The European Information Society Institute. And they did their intervention. They touched on many crucial issues. And I think it was a great one. And you will see that the court also builds on the arguments they put forward. So, yes, it was not just PI, it was also another organization. Now, to get back to Gassi's question about the sort of value of interventions or so on, interventions are very tricky, especially in international fora or before international bodies, like in this case, the European Court of Human Rights, because you don't really know if your intervention makes a difference or if your intervention is something that's taken into account or if it eventually ends up having impact. Measuring impact in this very context is almost impossible or an extremely difficult task because you will never get a judgment by the court saying that, oh, we really value the input of the intervener or so many thanks to the intervener because they opened our eyes or because they made us see that we saw this perspective to this issue and it really helped us understand. So thank you, intervener. There is no mention because, as I said before, the case predominantly has to do with the two parties, the person bringing the complaint, the applicant, and the government against which the complaint is filed. So it's not that the court will ever care that much about an intervener. Obviously, they will read it. Obviously, they might take it to account more or less, but it's not easy for you as an intervener to be able to identify the exact relation between your intervention and the outcome in the case and how much your intervention contributed to that very outcome or not. Our case is different, however, after all this introduction that I made, because we have in this very case, the interesting bit was that there were several references made by the court in the judgment to our interventions. Wow. Both implicit and explicit ones. Wow. So implicit ones in a sense of embracing language or arguments or thoughts we put forward in our intervention. Explicit ones by explicitly citing our interventions. For example, saying this is a point that was also mentioned by the intervener there. Or this was like an issue that was also discussed by the intervener in their intervention there. So there was explicit reference, like you could tell that like our interventions were sort of accompanying the court's opinion and the court's reasoning, leading to whether there is a violation of privacy or not eventually. And there was.
That's really cool. It's also the court saying to the Russians, if you don't like what we're saying, you can blame PI.
Exactly, exactly. Or maybe the court saying, you know, Yanis needs a raise, for example. But yeah, I don't think it happens very often. And I'm also not saying it in a, oh my God, PI is so amazing. We make the court like cite us. not at all. More in a, I think it was great timing. I think the stars aligned on February 13th, the day the judgment was handed down. And suddenly the timing was perfect. The measure that was being challenged was very bad. The arguments were quite solid and technically solid as well. And it was like hundreds of factors that probably contributed to this outcome. But what matters is now that we have an explicit standard, explicit ruling by the court with regards to encryption and encrypted communications, and a very clear message to governments that no, taking advantage of backdoors of online messaging platforms, for example, is a no-go. Oh my God, that was a great quote. We should use it for the trailer.
We should definitely use it for the trailer. I gotta say, like, as an old fart, I started covering crypto issues in the 1990s. I never would have imagined a European Court of Human Rights judgment. I would never have imagined relatively old judges who are not necessarily accustomed to technology anywhere in the world would have come to such a brave conclusion. And so I kind of have to believe that senior lawyering played a role in that happening. But it's a huge moment.
It is. Maybe to some extent, for sure. But yeah, like getting a first judgment on this highly technical, difficult topic and getting it so well the first time, it exceeded all our expectations. I was not expecting the court would go that far on its first time.
Yeah, I think also being an old fart, the first time I saw the European Court do something similar was actually in the DNA case in Marper in 2008,
yes,
where DNA is very complicated. The powers that the UK was using was very complicated and a little bit nuanced. And again, the European Court was able to say, okay, we understand this stuff. And no, you can't do it. That was really nice to see. And the reason I raised that one is because they also quoted us back then, which was sweet.
And as you said, like back then, that was a landmark case, the DNA one, like it shook Europe. And it's such a landmark case that what came out of it is that it also provided some general guidelines when it comes to general and discriminate measures. And now you see all other courts in Europe, not just the European Court of Human Rights, but the Court of Justice of the EU too, bringing this in because this relates to the issue we discussed about, oh, it just concerned the UK. No, because in every other country or whenever it has to do with something else, it concerns the interpretation of that specific provision of the convention. So be that, for example, indiscriminate video recordings, be that, for example, indiscriminate duration of evidence collected or whatever it is, Marper is being brought in as precedent. So it continues to live on many years after it was decided in like 2008, 2009.
Do we have any plans to follow up with this case with more senior lawyering in the future? Like, is this a watch this space kind of thing?
If the opportunity arises, yeah. We need to update the case page that I haven't done yet, as became evident during this recording, and the kind of disclosure of the Russian response for the first time on air. But we also have the Telegram case that we're expecting to be handed down relatively soon. Let's not forget about that. That touches both on privacy and freedom of expression. And now we're very hyped after the February 13th judgment because we're expecting a similar kind of vibe from the court when it comes to the Telegram versus Russia case, which is like a bigger one in terms of substance and issues that it touches on, etc. So fingers crossed, there's going to be like a pleasant surprise there as well. And as always, my colleagues and I continue monitoring developments, looking out for spicy cases communicated to governments by the European Court of Human Rights and seeing if there is a very novel issue that we could further assist the court by doing an intervention. But I feel like, as a general observation, all things encryption are no longer theoretical, they have started receiving practical applications. So we're going to see a lot more senior lawyering happening on that topic. Let's just hope it's a good kind of lawyering and not a bad one, because I don't think we can afford lots of mistakes in that area.
Thanks for listening. Remember, you can sign up to be the first to learn more about our work at pvcy.org/podsignup. And we'll include some links to the relevant documents and information in the description wherever you're listening or on our website at pvcy.org/techpill. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you use. Music courtesy of Sepia. This podcast was produced by Max Burnell for Privacy International. Math.
My internet has died. Hopefully they're having a really great conversation and everything's all good.